Hey, we're as Jay would say, we're going to look at the book of Jonah. So if you've got a Bible and do pull it out, I think there are Bibles in the pews. Jonah's one of those small books of the Bible. If you get to Micah, Nahum, Obadiah, or Habakkuk, stuff like that, go backwards. But it's after the big ones like Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel, somewhere in the middle. We're going to look at Jonah chapter 1, and I'm just going to start by reading the chapter. Now the word of the Lord came to Jonah, the son of Amittai, saying, "Arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and call out against it, for their evil has come up before me." But Jonah rose to flee to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. He went down to Joppa and found a ship going to Tarshish, so he paid the fare and went on board to go with them to Tarshish away from the presence of the Lord. But the Lord hurled a great wind upon the sea, and there was a mighty tempest on the sea, so that the ship threatened to break up. Then the mariners were afraid, and each cried out to his God. And they hurled the cargo that was in the ship into the sea to lighten it for them. But Jonah had gone down into the inner part of the ship and had lain down and was fast asleep. So the captain came and said to him, "What do you mean, you sleeper? Arise, call out to your God. Perhaps the God will give a thought to us that we may not perish." And they said to one another, "Come, let us cast lots that we may know on whose account this evil has come upon us." So they cast lots, and the lot fell on Jonah. Then they said to him, "Tell us on whose account this evil has come upon us. What is your occupation?" That's my favorite line right there. What's your, like, in the storm, what's your job? "And where do you come from? What is your country? And of what people are you?" And he said to them, "I am a Hebrew, and I fear the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land." Then the men were exceedingly afraid and said to him, "What is this that you have done?" For the men knew that he was fleeing from the presence of the Lord, because he had told them. Then they said to him, "What shall we do to you that the sea may quiet down for us?" For the sea grew more and more tempestuous. He said to them, "Pick me up, hurl me into the sea, then the sea will quiet down for you. For I know it is because of me that this great tempest has come upon you." Nevertheless, the men rowed hard to get back to dry land, but they could not, for the sea grew more and more tempestuous against them. Therefore they cried out to the Lord, "O Lord, let us not perish for this man's life, and lay not on us innocent blood, for you, O Lord, have done as it pleased you." So they picked up Jonah and hurled him into the sea, and the sea ceased from its raging. Then the men feared the Lord exceedingly, and they offered a sacrifice to the Lord and made vows. And the Lord appointed a great fish to swallow up Jonah. And Jonah was in the belly of the fish 3 days and three nights. Let's pray. God, this is a story that so many of us, if not all of us, have heard before, if not heard many, many times. This is just one of those oldies and goodies. But Lord, I pray that as we come to this text again today, maybe for the first time reading out of an adult Bible, Lord, I pray that you would speak to us anew as you promised to do again and again. Lord, I pray that you would tell us your heart in this word, that your heart for us and for this hurting world. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. So I'm supposed to be, theoretically, I'm supposed to be able to deal with this cold. I grew up in Michigan. I live in Los Angeles now, and I'm so soft. I'm seriously considering preaching 3 hours today just so I don't have to go outside again. That's like 80% a joke. I'm supposed to be able to deal with this because I'm from Michigan, and I'm not from the Michigan where everybody is from, right? I'm not from Detroit and the suburbs. I'm from northern Michigan, where deer outnumber people by like 100 to 1, and it is cold up there. It hasn't helped me at all today. It was tough getting here, but it's wonderful to be here. It does remind me of a story in Michigan because it was so cold, and basically what we would do all winter is we would stay inside. I see a couple nodding heads because I think some of you guys are from climates like this. We'd stay inside. We'd play euchre, and you know, occasionally we'd venture out to the bowling alley. But basically we would never go outside. And then what would happen in the spring, right? It's just the wonder of the seasons that we in Los Angeles never see. But in the spring, we, you know, things would start to melt and we'd go outside and we'd appreciate seasons and grace, which is, you know, just not something we understand in California. And one of the things that you know, young lads like I would like to do, we just do stupid stuff because there's not a lot to do in Northern Michigan. We would take our cars, often, you know, the whether they were two-wheel drive or four-wheel drive or one-wheel drive, you know, we would take our cars, and when the snow started to melt, we would start to do what we did all summer, which is just really cool. We would drive them through the back trails in the woods, right? We had these things called two tracks, and we would just, it's just really, I mean, I'm just a really cool guy, right? That's the kind of stuff that I would do. Anyway, the cold reminded me of one time that I did that. I was the snow had melted, we were driving out there, and as we got deeper and deeper into the woods, we actually realized that not all the snow in Northern Michigan had melted. And there was a little bit of snow, and we drove further, and there was more snow. We drove further and further, and the car got stuck, right? Just in the middle of nowhere. Amazingly, and this is just one of the many graces that the Lord showed me that day, my parents that year had installed something that some of you may never have heard of before. They had installed something called a car phone into our car, so I was able to call my mother. It was a difficult conversation. She called a tow truck company. The tow truck company came out, and I'm gradually getting to the point of this whole thing. The tow truck got stuck in the snow, right? And then they had to call like another tow truck company, except this one was from like 3 hours away in downstate Michigan, and they came with one of those tow trucks that tows other trucks, right? It's like bigger than a Mack truck. Yeah, I'm seeing a few of you guys know this. That truck came out and towed the first tow truck out, right? And then came back and got me. Anyway, my mother thought it would be a growing experience, and it was, if I were to pay for this whole thing. And so what I learned is that in such a situation, the stranded motorist, right, the basically innocent party out there, is responsible for both tow trucks, right? Right. I had to pay for the tow truck that got stuck, right? The first attempt and the big one. And I've never been tow tracking since that day. Or that was it. So it worked. In essence, what I needed was a rescuer. And my mother called the rescuer, and the rescuer came out, and what we found real quick is that the rescuer needed a rescuer, right? That's the book of Jonah, right? I mean, we could end right there. I won't because it's so cold outside, but we could end right there, right? Right? The book of Jonah is a rescuer who needs a rescuer. And this is a fun book. This is literally one of my favorite books of the Bible, right? First of all, it's got adventure and suspense. And I realize that pastors are supposed to tell you that all the books of the Bible are like adventurous, but they're not, right? I mean, there's just a lot of the books of the Bible where, you know, there's just some trucking you got to do. Not Jonah, right? I mean, Jonah's a fun book. There's a cliffhanger at the end of every chapter in Jonah, which is not something that happened in the 8th century BC, right? People didn't write like young adult fiction back then, right? But this is an exciting book. It's also a fun book because we know the story of Jonah, or at least we think we do, right? This is just one of those stories, right? The whale eats the dude and vomits him, right? Like we know that story, and yet when we come and actually start to read it and actually start to think carefully, it may be. It may not be, right? But it may be that the Lord has something completely new to tell us from this book than we ever got when we were little and learning this book out of the children's Bible Bible story, right? Another reason that I love Jonah is I find it just one of the most believable books in the entire Bible, which is strange because a central element, as you guys know, of this story is that there's a dude who spends 3 days and three nights in a fish, right? But I actually think it is an incredibly believable book, and this is why. It's because had I been writing the Bible, had I been putting together the Bible, there's no way I put the book of Jonah in, right? Because guess who comes off really, really poorly in the book of Jonah, right? Jonah, right? He's a chump. And he doesn't stop being a chump, right? Even at the end, right? Right? Like as you guys work through Jonah through a month, you're gonna see that Jonah actually comes off really, really poorly, right? The prophet of God. And the people who come off really well in this book, right, are people called the Ninevites. They're Assyrians. They are the greatest enemies of God's people at this time, right? This book doesn't make sense as propaganda. In fact, the only reason that I can think of for its inclusion in the Bible is that it's actually true. I mean, we're getting ahead of ourselves. You guys can decide that for yourselves after you work through these four chapters. But I think it's going to be a good month. Right, starting with today's story, which, like my escapades in those northern Michigan woods, involves a series of rescue missions that are launched by a loving God. All right, but that's what we're going to work through today. We're going to work through three rescue missions launched by a loving God. We're going to find the first rescue mission in the first two verses here. And the first rescue mission that is launched is a rescue mission to these people called the Ninevites. Look at me in verses 1 and 2. Now the word of the Lord came to Jonah, the son of Amittai, saying, "Arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and call out against it, for their evil has come up before me." Now, on the face of it, I understand. So I'm gonna propose to you guys that this is a crazy, shocking statement here, right? And I understand that on the face of it, it's not, because it's got some really standard kind of Old Testament elements here, right? One, we've got a prophet, right? Right in the first verse there, right? Now the word of the Lord came to Jonah, the son of Amittai. It's got a prophet. Right, and Jonah's our prophet. We don't find a lot of details about Jonah elsewhere, but we do see him. Right, you'll see him back in 2 Kings. Jonah was a prophet under the reign of a guy called Jeroboam the second of Israel, who was a fairly successful king, but under whose kingship the nation started to come under pressure from the Assyrian Empire. Okay, this is sort of 789 to 748 BC, give or take. Right, and so we got this prophet, right? That makes sense. The second thing that we've got, kind of standard Old Testament element here, is we've got an oppressor people, right? We've got a people who are oppressing God's people, and these ones are real doozies. Okay, we've got these Ninevites here. Arise, go to Nineveh. Okay. So Nineveh is an ancient city. It's actually located where the current day Iraqi city of Mosul is. Okay, so that's where Nineveh is on the banks of the Tigris. Nineveh, it was not just some random city, 600 miles away from Israel. However, the significance of Nineveh is that Nineveh was the capital of the Assyrian Empire. Okay, Nineveh is the capital of the Assyrian Empire, which at that time had set its sights on Israel and was starting to pressure Israel, probe its defenses. The Assyrians were, like so many empires before or after them, they were trying to conquer the world. What set apart the Assyrians was their particular reputation for cruelty. Right, it seemed that these guys, I'm not going to go into the details because it's pretty grotesque, but it seemed like these guys just spent their days imagining new ways to torture and kill and display the corpses of their enemies. And they would do so for propaganda purposes, right? So successfully that often the Assyrian army would just show up at an enemy city, and the enemy city would say, "Hey, we're yours," right? Just to avoid the fates of those before me. That this really came home to me at a kind of a gut level way, and actually it really helped me to understand Jonah more, the book of Jonah more. This past summer, I was in London at the British Museum, and at the British Museum they have a whole bunch of reliefs from ancient Assyria, right? So they had these carved stone tablet kind of thingies, which showed pictures and pictorials from the ancient world. And these Assyrian ones were remarkable. They had, you know, they had normal stuff. They had elephants and thrones and diplomats and stuff like that. But on this one particular one, behind the throne, right? So there's the throne and all the fancy stuff. Behind the throne was a line of prisoners, okay? Line of prisoners who were coming up to an executioner, and then behind the executioner on the very far edge of the relief was a pile of human heads, right? And at first I was like, okay, well, ancient world. And then I realized that's not the ancient world, is it? Right? That's not the ancient world. That's a kind of evil that is neither ancient nor long departed. In fact, it's a kind of evil that continues across the world today, including, perhaps most poignantly, in the same exact place as it did in Assyria. You see, to understand the evil of Nineveh, and I think actually to understand the book of Jonah, this is going to become really, really important in chapters 3 and 4, but to understand the evil of Nineveh and to understand the book of Jonah, I think we need to understand that we have a Nineveh today. And we have an Assyria today, and they go by the name of Isis. Their largest city is Mosul, the site of ancient Nineveh. Their appetite for violence and for cruelty seems to know no bound. They seem to have an especial hatred for God's people. They bask in human suffering, using it in their publicity machine as they march across the Fertile Crescent. This is how we must understand Nineveh. And thus the story of Jonah. Okay, so we've got a prophet. We've got an oppressor people. The last kind of standard thing that we've got about the Old Testament here in these first two verses, right? We've got a message against them. You see it there. A call out against it, for their evil has come up before me. This is standard prophetic fare. God's got a lot of judgment in store, right? Now, he spends a lot of time in the Old Testament talking about his own people most of the time, but he's also got some significant time where he talks about these oppressor nations, right? And so this is kind of standard stuff. Prophet, wickedness, message of judgment. But there's something different about Jonah. There is something unique about Jonah. Right, prophet, oppressor people, message of judgment. There's something unique about Jonah that is not true in any other in any other book of the Old Testament. Right, in fact, probably the most helpful contrast with Jonah is another prophet called Nahum. Right, Nahum was going to write 100 years later. He's a prophet, and he's going to write to Nineveh. He's going to write to the same people, and he's going to have the same message. He's going to say, you're going to be destroyed, right? Jonah, we'll see in chapter 3, is going to have that message, right? Right. In three days, this town will be destroyed. So Nahum actually says the same exact thing as Jonah, but Jonah's different. There are two words in these opening verses, and if you don't sort of take away anything else, take away these two words, because this will help us to understand Jonah. There are two words in these opening verses that completely separate Jonah from Nahum, and that change both the purpose of the whole prophecy and the course of Jonah's life. Here are the two words. You find them beginning in verse 2. Arise, go to Nineveh. Go to Nineveh. That actually changes everything. The content's going to remain the same, but the meaning is going to completely change. Because you see, Nahum is going to prophesy about Nineveh, just like Obadiah prophesies about Edom and Isaiah prophesies about the surrounding nations. But Jonah is going to prophesy to Nineveh. Okay, now to understand this difference, you got to think about a quarterback dropping back, right? He's looking downfield, and what he's not seeing, right, back on his blind side, is this 300-pound monster, right, who's about to lay him out, right? And all of us are back on back home and watching TV and we're saying, oh man, right? He is gonna get hit, right? And we're either like sad or glad about it, depending on what side we're, right? But we're back home and we're saying he's gonna get hit. But there's another guy who's got the same message. His teammate, right? His teammate who's about 10 feet away, he can't block the guy, but what he can do is he can yell to the quarterback. He says, you're going to get hit. Right? Right. Same message. The guy's going to get hit. Completely different meaning, isn't it? Because the teammates on the field, the teammates using this as a warning to the quarterback, whereas we're just sort of gloating about it. And that's what's going on in Jonah. That's what makes Jonah unique among the Old Testament prophets. He is being sent to an enemy nation. He is being sent onto the field. He's being sent to warn Nineveh. And maybe even to turn them to God. Over this next month, we're going to see God mount and carry out a rescue mission on behalf of the most wicked empire the world had ever known at that point. And that is going to raise a whole bunch of super awkward questions for us and super awkward questions for Jonah. And we're not going to get into that right now. Right? But we're going to have to wrestle hard eventually with that kind of grace. As Jonah did, and maybe even be scandalized by it, as Jonah was. But we got time to do that later. For now, it's enough for me that God is mounting a rescue mission to the vilest, to the most abominable city on earth, to save the worst that have ever lived. Sin is great, but God's love is scandalously greater. And there is no one in this room and there is no one on this planet who has put him or herself beyond the love or the power of this great God. Because this God's about rescue. And we may be thinking to ourselves, but you don't know what I've done. And that is totally true. I have no clue what you've done. And you don't know what I've done, which is why I'm preaching here today, right? There's no chance I'd be preaching here if you knew what I'd done. But the Lord does. And the Lord knows you, and he loves us anyway. Hundreds of years after Jonah, Jesus sat and ate with tax collectors and prostitutes, and when he was questioned, when he was called out on it, he reminded people, he reminded his peers that those who thought God was looking for, quote, good people, they weren't right. He said, I came to call not the righteous, but sinners. That's the first of our rescue missions. Second one we're gonna spend a much briefer time on, but there's a second rescue mission in this chapter. God's all about rescue. This is going to end up being a rescue mission to these mariners, to these sailors that we see here. Right? If God's first rescue mission, which was to Nineveh, reminds us that no one is beyond God's rescue, his second mission to deliver these sailors now shows us that no other rescue will save. That's what we see in verses 4 through 16. These poor sailors, they don't have a clue what they're picking up when they pick up Jonah in Joppa. And even when they learn, verse 10 tells us that at some point they learn that he's running from God. They don't really care until the storm comes. Right? They're just doing their thing. They're just sailing our boat. And in some ways, I find the sailors the most relatable in the story, right? They're not chopping off heads. They're not like deliberately running away from God. They're just sailing their boat. They're just doing their thing, right? And maybe that's us. Maybe we're sailing our boat. But the storm does come, as it always does. And doesn't verse 5 seem to describe us well when those storms hit? Then the mariners were afraid and each cried out to his God, and they hurled the cargo that was in the ship into the sea to lighten it for them. And those are our two responses, or at least they're my responses in the storm. The first thing is that I'm going to start crying out to all those things that I've planned on to save me. All those things that I have invested in and worshiped through my life. Right now, I have different gods than the household idols of these mariners. But think about the bank account that I've been slowly building up to save me in the storm, right? Think about the career that I've been putting together. Right. Think about the medical system. Right. Right. Or maybe our esoterically our economic system, our political system that I've invested in and expected to save me. Think about sex. Think about that current or prospective romantic partner that I've said that's what's going to save me. And then when those things don't deliver, well then I start lightening my boat. Then I said, okay, well forget it. Nothing worked out the way it was supposed to. So I'm going to pull myself up by my own bootstraps. Right? I'm going to dig myself out of my hole. I'm going to lighten the boat just like the sailors. Don't we turn to our own self-sufficiency and ingenuity? The thing that gets me about this story is that these sailors, they're good people. They're really good people. Do you notice that after Jonah's like, yeah, okay, I think I know what this is all about, guys, right? This is me. And he says, why don't you chuck me in the drink, right? Do you see in verse 13 what they do? Nevertheless, the men rowed hard to get back to dry land, but they could not, for the sea grew more and more to bed. They tried. They didn't even know this clown. And they tried to save him at their own risk, but they can't do it. They're good people, but it turns out that neither good intentions nor strong arms nor any of the gods that they've come to trust over their lives, none of these things can save them. Yeah, one thing can, and that's what we see in this story. Only one God can save them, and it's to him finally. And man, too often we do this at the end of our rope like these guys, but finally, verse 14, finally it's to him that they call. You know, they started out at the beginning of the story crying out to many gods. But what do we have by the end of this story? Forget the Jonah bit for a bit. We're going to get back to Jonah, right? But look at these sailors. They were crying out to all these gods. At the end of the story, they are calling out to the one true God. They are worshiping him. They are committing their lives to him, right? That's what God's after. I mean, the big point of Jonah has nothing to do with these sailors. And yet, it's almost as if God can't help himself because he's a rescuing God. And these sailors learn. They learn that there is only one rescue that can save. My prayer is that this church would just grow ever fuller with these kind of worshipers. Worshipers who realize that there's one rescue out there. Last one, rescue mission number three. And rescue mission number three is a mission, like to the Ninevites, that's going to span the course of our whole book. Because rescue mission three is to the rescuer himself. Rescue mission three is the story of Jonah. He's that little tow truck that was sent out to get my Subaru, right? And needed the Mack truck next. The third rescue mission, this one to Jonah himself, soberly reminds us that no one, even if we think that we're a nice little tow truck here, right, there's no one who is without need of rescue ourselves. Jonah is the ultimate religious insider of the time. And not only is he a Jew, and at the time God had only revealed himself to the Jews, so he's already in like the 1% of the world. But not only is he a Jew, he's a prophet, right? And the really cool thing about being a prophet is that you get to talk directly to God, which was not something that most people got to do. Most people, when they wanted to know what God was saying, they would have to come to Jonah and say, what's God saying? But not Jonah. You see it in verse 1, right? The word of the Lord came to Jonah. God and Jonah, they spoke one-on-one. But his insider status, his life story, his occupation, even his proximity to God's word, these things do not save him in the storm. These things do not rescue him. Because there's a huge problem with Jonah, and it's got nothing to do with whether he's an insider or outsider. God doesn't care about those distinctions. He's going after the Ninevites, right? The big problem is that Jonah has taken control of his life. Jonah has refused to let this God who speaks to him and speaks through him to the people, he's refused to let this God have control of his life. Now he's fine, right? When he's back in Israel, right, and he's doing his prophet thing, he's very cool with, you know, being down with God and being the Holy One. In fact, what we learn from 2 Kings is that Jonah was one of the very few prophets that people actually liked back then. His prophetic ministry for much of his life seemed to be to prophesy. Like the major thrust was to say, "O King Jeroboam, your land is going to get bigger." Like that's a very rare prophet in the Old Testament. That usually they said your land's getting smaller, right? But he had a good ministry and he was well liked. And I'm sure he was very down with being the God guy, right? Back in Samaria. But when God shows up and says, "Okay, now it's time to go to Nineveh, and now it's time to take a message that you are really, really not going to be excited about taking." You guys will talk about that later in 3 and 4. Right? Well, you see where Jonah heads. You can't miss it in the first three verses because it's repeated three times. Look, in the Bible, they didn't have, biblical times, they wrote these things on scrolls. They didn't have Microsoft Word. They didn't have any kind of control B for bold or italics or underline or anything like that, right? If biblical writers wanted to emphasize something, they would just repeat it, right? And so when you see repetition, right, that's not because they're bad writers. It's because they're emphasizing something. So look with me in verse three, right? "But Jonah rose to flee to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. He went down to Joppa and found a ship going to Tarshish. So he paid the fare and went down into it to go with them to Tarshish," right? If we're in eighth grade and we write that in a paper, right? The teacher just circles it, says, "Don't use that word three times in a sentence," right? But the point of the author here is to say Tarshish, right? Right? As if we didn't get it. I have no idea where Tarshish is. No, nobody does either. So don't take anything to the bank. Probably the best guess is somewhere actually in Spain. But what's very clear is that you have to travel on the Mediterranean to get to Tarshish, wherever it is, right? Which means that you're heading west, right? You're heading west, right? It's probably not going to take like biblical scholars among you to guess which direction Nineveh was. Right. Nineveh was east, right? The emphasis here is that Jonah is saying, "I'm in charge of my life. And this is how it's going to go down, God," right? I'll take what you've got while I like it, right? But whenever it doesn't line up with what I think my life should look like or my ministry should look like or your world should look like, that's a big part of Jonah. He's saying, "God, I don't like that picture of your world." Then he takes control of his life and he goes to Tarshish. And he realizes this, doesn't he, while he's on the boat. He realizes this. And he realizes that there is no place in this world which is outside the presence of the Lord. He realizes that the Lord is the maker of the sea and land. And Jonah realizes that there is only one thing. There's only one thing that will allow God to rescue him again. And that one thing is to die. Because let's not have any illusions, right? I mean, the fish is just so ridiculous to us today. Let's not think that, like, back in Jonah's time, this was a regular thing, right? Fish didn't just come and eat people and then spit them up later, right? When Jonah says, "Throw me into the deeps," Jonah is saying, this is it. And that's what happens. That's what happens. Jonah is cast into the deep. And Jonah is cast to his depth, to his death, and then and only then does the fish show up, and eventually our story continue. This fish is not here to eat Jonah. This is not a punishment. This fish, right, is God's agent to rescue his rescuer. But he had to die first. While he's on the ship and heading to Tarshish, Jonah is beyond rescue. He's refusing rescue. It's when he's in the water. It's when he's sinking beneath the waves. It's when he says, Lord, I'm not in control anymore. This is not my life to lead. That's when he meets his rescue. That's when he comes face to face with his rescuer. It's a funny looking rescuer, but you know, it's the Lord. Jonah's status, his religiosity, his knowledge of the word, his occupation, his family background, none of that would rescue him. Jonah dying to himself, that's when the Lord showed up. We're just about out of time, but I do want to mention one more rescue mission that the Lord launches. It's not necessarily in the pages here in Jonah, although very deliberately these pages look forward to it. There's one more rescue mission. It happened a few hundred years later, when the Lord would send a rescuer. Again, the Lord would see a people who are lost in wickedness, like the Ninevites. He would see a people who are crying out to various hopes and gods and depending on themselves. He would see a people who have taken their own places on the thrones of their lives. And again, he would send a rescuer. This one would not come reluctantly like Jonah, right? And this one would not need a rescuer himself. This time it would be God's son. And when that rescuer showed up, he would actually tell the people that he encountered that there was one sign that he planned to give them, that he was in fact who he said he was going to be. And that sign, he said, was the sign of Jonah. Because like Jonah, this man would be cast to his death. Unlike Jonah, this man would not be rescued. Jesus would go to the cross. He'd go to the cross for the Ninevites of this world. He'd go to the cross for the sailors of this world. He'd go to the cross for the insiders, the Jonas of this world. And this is the rescue that we would need. Someone, again, who would die, but of his own accord, and not for his own crimes. And that man, like Jonah in the whale, he wouldn't stay in the ground. He'd rise again, this time not to temporarily put a pause on the wickedness of Nineveh, but this time to permanently pay for and wipe out the sins of the world. This is the rescue mission that Jonah looks forward to, and which we will have a really fun month thinking about. Now we all have a time of response at the end of the sermon. Our time will conclude with the offering of and tithes. But before we get to that point, I'm hoping that we can consider the rescue mission that God has mounted for all of us. And I don't know if our lives look more like the Ninevites, if we're total outsiders, if we've never been in a church before and we're just like, but you don't know what I've done. I don't know if our lives look more like the sailors. We're just doing our thing, sailing our boat, but we are not ready for the storm. I don't know if our lives look more like Jonah. We have sat in these pews for 50 years, but we're still in charge of our own lives. Maybe we're completely different too. Maybe we need a completely different kind of rescue. I don't know what that looks like, but I do know that all of us need the Lord. And whatever that is, whatever that distress that we're in, there is rescue for us all. But it only comes from one God, and it only comes when we die to ourselves. Let's take this time to consider what if anything, we're holding back from him, and how we can receive that rescue. If this is the very first day that some of us want to say, yes, Lord, I'm ready to be rescued. I would love to talk with you afterwards. Pastor Jay would love to talk with you afterwards. Your oldest Christian friend would just love you to call her on the phone afterwards.